CJSF 90.1 FM जो कि बर्नबी ब्रिटिश कोलंबिया में स्थित है।
If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor news, environmental discussion, and social justice, Rabble Radio is your new favorite podcast. Tune in to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or on rabble.ca today.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, artificial intelligence, existential threats to humanity, or just the basic civil rights?
Algorithmic systems are perpetuating very real harms and kind of further entrenching them into these systems. So you have things like, you know, predictive policing or deciding whether or not somebody gets approved for a loan, or even intimate things like, you know, medical decisions or, you know, your likeness. All of these things are amplified by AI.
Personal DNA testing. You never know what you'll find.
What's beautiful about this, I find, it's just so personally intimate, because it's telling me about my DNA makeup. When I got this and it said that you're 2% Neanderthal, it just rocked my world. I didn't even know how to react to it.
And forever chemicals in the blood of pregnant moms and their babies.
People in the U.S. are exposed to multiple different toxic chemicals from their environment, from their consumer products. We just don't know very much about them. And overall, maternal mortality in the U.S. is among the worst in the developed world. Pregnancy-related complications are increasing, and it's not clear why. And so the next step is really to look at our environmental exposures, because we're really exposed to a toxic soup of chemicals in our environment.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. In a recent appeal to the world, Geoffrey Hinton and 180 other leading computer scientists and notables issued a warning about the existential threats to humanity posed by not climate change, not the demise of Earth's biosphere, but artificial intelligence, AI. Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI, their statement reads, should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. 22 words. Talk about concise. According to others, the prospects of human extinction at the hands of self-reproducing, self-defending generative AI systems and Uber robots are overblown. The scariest things about AI, they warn, are much more mundane. Dylan Baker is a research engineer at the Distributed AI Research Network. I reached Dylan in Seattle. Just recently, following the Screen Actors Guild AFTRA strike, SAG-AFTRA, and one of their principal grievances is artificial intelligence, that the film industry now has the capacity to create the likenesses of well-known actors using artificial intelligence, including, of course, their images, their voices, their styles. I find this astonishing. How is this possible?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I think we have known has been coming for a while, like the issues of things like deepfakes and other ways of just sort of like recreating people's likenesses in increasingly convincing ways has been sort of coming down the pike since, I don't know, 2015, 2016. This has become increasingly possible through deep learning, through a lot of different generative AI approaches that come from the world of computer vision.
I mean, this is legalized identity theft.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it really highlights that a lot of the issues that we're seeing with the negative impacts of AI today are really like labor issues and privacy issues, which we've been struggling with for ages.
Let me quickly ask you, Geoffrey Hinton and others, Geoffrey Hinton, one of the founding lights of artificial intelligence, some months ago, his, their 22-word statement declaring that artificial intelligence now posed an existential threat to humanity, which created a whole lot of buzz. Do you think that artificial intelligence today and looking forwards 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, when it is vastly improved by orders of magnitude, that it poses an existential threat to humanity?
I think it's a bad framing. I think the framing really sort of serves the bottom line of these big tech companies that, you know, oh, we're creating something that is somehow fundamentally different than everything that's ever been created before. And, you know, it's so powerful that you need to give us even more funding and even more attention and, you know, divert even more resources into what we're building so that we don't, you know, build it wrong and destroy humanity. And I think it also plays into this sort of like popular media, sort of like sci-fi collective imagination that has been around for ages. I think they're really playing on that. But I think there are, I wouldn't characterize them as like existential threats, but there are so many threats and real world impacts that these technologies are having and that they'll continue to have and continue to exacerbate as we sort of develop them and put more resources into them, unless we start to mitigate these harms now. So we're looking at massive sort of shifts in how people's jobs work. We're seeing a lot of sort of like the same labor issues that we see elsewhere, you know, people being displaced from more protected jobs or more creative jobs, either sort of put out of work or put into, you know, like low level cleaning and scraping data, sort of harvesting it and stealing it from different platforms to feed these large models. In 2016, Kathy O'Neill put out Weapons of Math Destruction, which I think really highlighted how a lot of sort of automated and algorithmic systems are perpetuating very real harms and kind of further entrenching them into these systems. So you have things like, you know, predictive policing or deciding whether or not somebody sort of gets approved for a loan or even really intimate things like, you know, medical decisions or, you know, your likeness or, you know, where, how your data gets sold to different data brokers. Like all of these things are amplified by AI. And, you know, that's something that's happening right now. And I think there's sort of this sleight of hand that's happening where they're like, you know, ignore all of these real, you know, these are just sort of trivial small things that will definitely get sorted out and not, we're entrenching existing issues of sort of power that exists in the world with the things that we're building and like, look over here, you know, it's because we're building, you know, the next sort of era of humanity. This is the final frontier, whatever.
I'm wondering if you can define what generative AI is for me and tell me whether or not you think that artificial intelligence systems could conceivably become self-improving or self-reproducing or rival human intelligence.
To start with the first one, generative AI is, I guess, in contrast to AI systems that might do something like classify different things or do like regressions or classifications that are trying to sort of like analyze and make predictions about data, or in the world of like games, maybe like, you know, your sort of quote unquote AI are animating, you know, how your bosses should fight or whatever. Generative AI is something that essentially uses some of those same structures, usually like neural networks, to create and sort of refine outputs. So like in the world of image generation, instead of trying to go through and make predictions about different sort of groups of pixels in an image or make a classification on a whole collection of pixels, it will generate a set of pixels and then go through iterations to sort of further alter and refine them. And you can even have sort of generative adversarial networks are one of the sort of like core types of generative AI, where you'll have two different networks say like, you know, I'm going to produce an image and you're going to make a classification about this image and then I'm going to adjust it, and they sort of go back and forth to arrive at some like final image. And it's a whole sort of wide world and it's changing all the time. But I think that's sort of the basic idea.
But I mean, when people talk about artificial intelligence becoming an existential threat, we conjure up, right? I mean, I looked back at 2001 Space Odyssey. I'm sure you've seen 2001 Space Odyssey with HAL. HAL 9000 was the heuristically programmed algorithmic computer created by Arthur Clarke that can read lips and has emotions and can protect itself and defend itself against Dave and his spacecraft mates who he's killed, HAL has. And so it's suddenly it's come to a mind of its own. So this is the kind of the image that people conjure up out there amongst those people who know nothing about these things. Can you imagine computers becoming artificial intelligence, becoming like that, like human beings, and being able to self-improve themselves and to reproduce themselves and to communicate with each other and to rival human intelligence and be able to actually thwart human aims? Or is this just science fiction?
Well, I think it's an anthropomorphization that I think is really sort of a major issue. Like a way that Emily Bender phrases this that I really like is that, you know, we don't say that, you know, submarines have superhuman diving ability or that airplanes have superhuman flying ability or, you know, like a shovel has superhuman digging ability, right? Like these are tools that we create for a specific purpose. And so-called sort of artificial intelligence, really what most people are referring to is machine learning, which is a specific set of sort of statistical techniques. These are just tools that we've made to serve certain purposes. And something that a lot of people are doing are building these tools to look very human and to be very easy to anthropomorphize. So like ChatGPT, for example, it's trained on an unfathomable amount of data that was just sort of scraped mostly from the internet and then refined by people. People were shown tons and tons of sort of ChatGPT prompts and responses and, you know, were asked like, is this reasonable? Is this feasible? Is this mostly correct? And was sort of further refined by people to look and sound like a person. And, you know, it's not surprising that it looks like an image of ourselves, but underneath the hood, this is not a person. This is not functioning and reasoning and responding, you know, with an actual sort of model of the world.
But I mean, I was watching something on television on Al Jazeera, and they were at some AI conference. This was really, really recently. And they had some robots sitting there that like looked like, you know, men and women. And they were, you know, journalists asked them questions and they answered. It sounded, and their eyes were blinking and they were nodding their heads and cocking their heads. And I realized that's all programmed and they were saying things, but they sounded really, geez, I mean, I suppose one can sit down with one of these computers for a couple of hours, robots for a couple of hours and see what its limits are. But it seems it's pretty awesome. It seems really human-like.
Yeah, it's exciting. It is very cool. It is a neat trick. But I think that's really what it is we are sort of creating these sort of facsimiles of ourselves. But underneath the hood, I think we are so far from sort of quote unquote, like thinking or reasoning about the world. And there are sort of models that people are making to sort of emulate particular tasks that people do. At its very core, these are tools that people are making for a purpose. And they can either sort of like meet those goals or not meet those goals. But the idea that we are sort of like creating sort of godlike entities, I think, is anthropomorphizing.
Let's talk about the more, shall we say, mundane concerns or worries about AI. What is algorithmic bias?
Algorithmic bias is looking at ways that algorithms treat people in discriminatory ways or sort of reinforce existing systems of discrimination and power differences.
So how does that play out or how is that being played out and how could it play out in AI systems? Algorithmic bias.
Right. I think bias is just sort of the tip of the iceberg, really. And so you see things like computer vision algorithms that were starting to be able to identify like human faces performing very poorly on people with black skin and especially women with black skin or darker skin. And that was a real issue, a sort of classic issue of like discrimination or bias. I think when you have a system that is already sort of at its core a sort of like harmful exercise of power, when you further sort of add technology into the mix and people, it gives it sort of this veneer of objectivity and, you know, sort of further amplifies and deepens and entrenches these systems of power that are sort of bad from the get-go. So like predictive policing or sentencing in a sort of carceral system where we're not preventing bad things from happening, we're sort of punishing and worsening a lot of harms.
And what do you mean by that predictive policing?
So predictive policing is a system basically where crime statistics are taken in a particular area that's usually like sort of purchased by a police department in a region. They get sort of crime statistics from that region, and that will inform where police officers are scheduled to patrol. And that can just sort of like, based on the classifications that we have for like what counts as a crime, all of these different sort of very fundamentally harmful measurements are then being used to sort of like further over-policing particular areas, and sort of has the self-reinforcing loop of keeping police in particular areas, which ups the sort of crime statistics in that area and continues to sort of police entire communities, which has all sorts of really dehumanizing and negative effects. And because it's viewed as this sort of objective, automated, algorithmic thing, it's like, you know, well, this isn't human bias. Like, this is something that we built so that we could avoid human bias and so that we could make these sort of calls in an objective way. And when people say, well, okay, but, you know, we'll change the algorithms, we'll tweak them to make them less biased, it ignores the fact that fundamentally sort of policing in the criminal justice system is to its core sort of rotten and is exacerbating harms. And when you think about an existential threat posed by AI, like, it is an existential threat if you're sort of like families are being broken apart and your communities are being traumatized. And what's more existential than that? Like, people are sort of dying on the streets and being murdered. And like that, you know, that has very real impact.
Reality corruption. I mean, we live in an age of, you know, fake news and the most astonishing conspiracy theories, QAnon, that tens of millions of Americans believe in. And we're being told that there's all this fake stuff being pumped out through social media by bots and other bad players, human players, which are distorting reality. We live in a supposedly post-truth world where you really can't believe anything that you see or read, even things that seem palpably real. And so artificial intelligence, it just seems to be arriving at the worst imaginable time.
I think it's a really good point that I think sort of misinformation and disinformation and sort of nonsense chatter and maliciously created information is a huge issue online and has been, and I think is very much exacerbated by generative AI models and large language models. You know, for example, you know, you see ChatGPT creating all sorts of junk content on the internet just to sort of like get page views and draw attention and get ad clicks. They'll send outputs of these systems to just people all over the world and ask them questions about it and be like, you know, does this sound reasonable? Is this correct? And people are now using systems like ChatGPT to provide these answers. And so you see it sort of starting to feed itself and sort of it becomes a sort of like echo chamber in and of itself that can sort of further create chaos and noise in these systems. And it's absolutely sort of has been and will continue to be used by bad actors to churn out content, I think, at a completely unprecedented rate.
And reinforce the these intellectual silos that people find themselves in, where people only communicate amongst themselves within their own silo, and they believe the same stories, which are diametrically opposed to the stories that other people tell.
Yeah, and we already have had issues with bots and astroturfing and creating a sense of a much larger community and much more content than is actually there. So a few actors can crank out thousands of bots that now sound more convincing than ever and make it seem like a particular viewpoint or a particular idea is spreading really quickly, and that can just sort of start a fire that then can become uncontrollable. So we see this with misinformation campaigns and election influence and, you know, very really real harms during global conflicts that can be exacerbated by this sort of online hate speech amplification.
And artificial intelligence really has an enormous potential to strengthen the global police state. And I immediately think about Israel, apartheid Israel, where they have the entire Palestinian population. They control the census, so they've got every name, they've got every phone number, they've got every address, and they're going around taking photos of people's faces when they go into people's homes and they photograph. It's like a contest amongst IDF soldiers where they kind of get the, you know, little kids into it and they're taking everybody's pictures. And so they're building up a database of facial images, which are being used now at checkpoints where they can just surveil the face of a person and they can immediately tell who they are, where they live, what their phone number is, who their family members are, what their social connections are. It's terrifying. And this technology is being sold to other governments around the world. And I mean, the Israelis are not the only ones who are doing this. It's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening in the US as well. Algorithmic systems and AI systems are really, really good at scaling things. So you can make something that was originally really painstaking, like, you know, photographing every person's face and putting it into, you know, files somewhere. You can get really cheap cameras and put them up everywhere. And, you know, it makes surveillance and strengthening of, exactly as you said, like the police state and strengthening of sort of violent militarized borders more and more possible.
Is this happening in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think different types of surveillance are really prevalent. I don't know, something that came up recently in Logic Mag, which is an incredible magazine, they were talking about how different sort of for-profit companies are digitizing mail that's sent to people who are incarcerated, and that'll be stored in a big common database. And if you have digital scans of people's mail, you now have a complete transcript automatically, you know, pulled from handwritten paper, if that's what you have. And you have a map of everybody's social connections. And so if you're talking about over-policing and hyper-surveillance of particular people and communities, like, you now have a population of people who, you know, not only could their mail be read before, but now, you know, it can be scanned and automated and sent to a database and, you know, profited off of, because they're for-profit companies that are now digitizing all of this mail and have these exclusive relationships with different prison systems. I mean, you have Face ID at the airport, you know, it comes in all of these different places, and things that can start off as seemingly innocuous, like, oh, we're just sort of matching this to your ID card and then we delete it immediately. If we don't have sort of strong protections in place that protect our privacy, oftentimes there are no guardrails to stop all of this information from being recorded and sold, and then you don't know who's using it and for what purposes.
Now, all of this is incredibly carbon intensive.
Yes.
Artificial intelligence consumes lots of energy.
Yeah, it's a similar problem to cryptocurrency mining, other things where you have massive server farms that are doing an incredible amount of computation to accomplish some of these tasks, because these models, the reason that they're able to do all of the things that they can do is they're absolutely massive. They take a huge amount of space, huge, huge, huge amounts of data. Yeah, it's incredibly carbon intensive, especially when we're using it to replace the things that people could otherwise do like fairly easily, or tasks that we already like, you know, weren't having trouble with. People are like, oh, we can just, you know, drop GPT into this, or we can just generate these images. And yeah, incredibly carbon intensive for really no real gain in a lot of situations, or sometimes active harm. You know, I'm hearing about, you know, doctors referring to ChatGPT for, you know, to sort of think things through, or people using it to sort of bounce ideas off the wall when ChatGPT does not have a sense of like truth and sort of facts and material reality. It's designed to sound convincing, which is incredibly dangerous.
And it's not, and it's, you've just alluded to an important point, that it's all very centralized by the very nature of the technology. It's controlled by a handful of giant IT companies.
Yes.
And so this brings us to the question of how AI, in your view, should be governed or regulated, Dylan Baker.
I think there are a lot of really good ideas and options out there. But I think fundamentally the things that we need to be concerned about are issues of sort of privacy and security, data autonomy. So meaning that if I provide my data to somebody, I have a right to know how it's being used. I have a right to withdraw it at any point. And not only withdraw it, but withdraw it from any sort of models that have been used. People also talk about sort of compensation. If my data is getting used for something and you're profiting off of it, I have a right to know like where it's going and how you're profiting. And I should be able to get compensated for that. I'm providing you something that's important for your work. I should be able to sort of sell this freely and withdraw it freely. And I think there are a lot of labor issues as well. Like, as you know, the Screen Actors Guilds are, I think, pointing out really saliently that, like, we need labor protections for everyone involved, everyone in general, but especially, you know, people who are involved in the pipelines of creating and deploying these systems. People need to be compensated and able to survive.
Where does public education fit in? What do we as consumers of technology need to know and do? And what powers do we need to have in order to ensure that AI doesn't become an existential threat, right? I mean, people need to understand. People need to be educated. It's us. We're the consumers of the technology and of the information.
Right. I think, as you pointed out, that the system right now is very anti-democratic. It's very opaque, very centralized, and sort of being developed with the bottom line being profiting a couple of very large corporations. And I think if people could see this as, one, something that's accessible for people to understand and not something that is like sort of godlike and larger than life, but really a tool that's being developed that we collectively have the power to push for legislation around and push for transparency around, that there are futures of technology where there is more sort of collective governance and collective creation of these tools so that they help sort of everybody. It is a public interest technology and not existing to further line the pockets of these big companies. So I think people understanding that these are issues that we can legislate about and organize around and fight for and make it very clear that everyone has a seat at that table and everybody should have a say and has a right to have a say in the tools that we build sort of as humanity, truly down to like a municipal level, because there are, I guarantee you, you know, every single cycle there are cities and small governments that are deciding, you know, whether or not to allow facial recognition by their local sort of police, or, you know, allowing, you know, how is the data from traffic cams being used? Because, you know, there are times in which if that data is available to a local government and there are protests going on, and we have facial recognition technology available, suddenly traffic cams can be used as a tool of surveillance. So I think finding out what's going on in your local community, issues in policing system, in school systems, people are making really big decisions about the roles that AI technology is going to play in all of those different sort of systems and facets of your life. And I think that can be a really great way to get started in advocating.
Dylan Baker, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much.
Dylan Baker is a research engineer at the Distributed AI Research Network. Dylan mentioned several critical works and websites focusing on AI. I'll post links to these and to DARE at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. If you're appreciating what you're hearing, go to greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe or donate or both. With your generous help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Secrets lurk within your personal genetic source code? How much DNA did you inherit from Neanderthals? Perhaps you're the proud owner of a sports gene. Hopefully no skeletons in the closet, like the Alzheimer's allele. Would you want to know? If so, consumer genome kits can oblige in exchange for a bit of spit. Here's a story of mine from 2013. I'll update after.
So it's just a small blade that's made out of compressed cotton, I believe.
Daryl Cole sits in his Winnipeg living room describing his plunge into direct-to-consumer genetic testing.
So I just take it and I scrape the inside of my cheek, which gives them a DNA sample.
Cole wasn't fretting over genes that might kill him. Family roots intrigued him the most. He slipped his cheek swab into a tube and popped it in the mail. A few weeks later, an update landed in his inbox.
It's freaky. It was a very tingly moment.
Finally, the big day arrived. He couldn't believe his eyes.
When I got this and it said that you're 2% Neanderthal, it just rocked my world. I didn't even know how to react to it.
Direct-to-consumer genome testing, it's called. The biggest name in the business is 23andMe. The California-based firm will send you a plastic